The following Real Assets Advisor podcast is a production of its parent company, IREI, Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For your most curated, intelligent news, data, and insights, visit realassetsadvisor.com and sign up today for our complimentary newsline and magazine using our new chat feature.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.
This is Mike Consul. Welcome to the program. Our guest today is Yoel Meyerfeld. He is co-CEO of Chase Properties, which has a significant presence in the retail space. And we're going to talk about retail today. That happens to be a real estate property type that has intimidated a lot of people, but there have been many changes in the space, and there have been many successes in the space as well. We want to talk a little bit with Mr. Meyerfeld about what the difference is here between those successes and failures, what's working in retail, what isn't. So with that, Yoel Meyerfeld, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Let me start with malls, because that has been such a big component of retail. And I'm talking about traditional malls that, which I don't know how many, there are obviously hundreds. I think there's 1,000 or more across the United States. Predictions that such a large percentage of them are either going to be repurposed or turn into hollow shells. But malls have taken on different forms these days. You hear about lifestyle malls, you hear about open air malls. What are you seeing that's working and not working in the mall space right now?
Sure. So yeah, I would differentiate malls from anything open air. So I don't think of any open air mall as a mall. I think of those as an open air shopping center and not the former, not indoor malls, traditional malls. Why I think they're failing is for two or three reasons. The main two reasons are the anchors. And by anchor, it means, you know, the big store, the big amount of square footage that is in a mall or a shopping center that is the biggest draw for shoppers to come to that asset have been failing. The Macy's, the Saks, those models of full price retail have not been where people want to spend their time and money.
You're talking about the big anchors?
Yes, correct.
But don't open air malls have big anchors as well?
Yes.
Or do they not? They do. Okay, so what's the difference? Okay, I don't want a roof when I shop, so I'm going to spend money if I don't have a roof and I can breathe the fresh air. But put a roof on it. You know, let's say it's Columbus, Ohio in the winter. I'm not going to go into an indoor mall. I'm going to look for an open air mall in a winter climate. I mean, what's the real difference here? Why would people go to an open air mall and not to a traditional mall?
So the anchors are different. In the open air centers, the anchors are Target. They are TJ Maxx. They're not Macy's. That's primary difference number one. Then outside of the department store differences or the anchor tenant differences is the convenience factor. We've become a convenience culture, which is why online has become such a strong player. And the way people like to shop is to quickly get in and out and do the thing that they want to do. And you can far easier do that in an open air center. Even pre-COVID, that was becoming, you know, extremely popular, and stores were already leaving malls and coming to shopping centers, and certainly in our portfolio. But COVID...
Okay, so let me just... That's an important distinction. You're saying pre-COVID... You know, this doesn't have anything to do with COVID. Open air was successful before COVID. Obviously, it gives it a bit of a boost, I would imagine, that, you know, we want to be outdoors because it's safer outdoors in terms of evading the virus. Psychologically, though, what's happened with the big anchors that, for instance, the Macy's you mentioned, the JCPenney's and such? Why before did, and I don't know if you can answer this question, Yoel, but this is part of the psychology of the consumer, right? It's that, hey, look, we can go into one, a Macy's, and we can find everything. We can find a sofa for the living room. I can find clothes for the kids. And I don't know if Macy's got into appliances ever. I know JCPenney did. Before, they wanted this emporium. And now what's happened is, no, parse it out. We want a separate store for the kids' clothes. We want a separate store for the women's clothes, a separate store for athletic wear, and so on. Is this just the predilections of the shopper changing for no apparent reason, or is there some kind of research behind it where the consumer has said, this is what we don't like about those big department stores anymore?
Sure. And just for 2 seconds, what I meant about COVID was less about health and more about the expediting of buy online, pickup in store. And that's what was really expedited through COVID, which has been very helpful for the open air centers. But in terms of it being for a reason or not, according to the research that I've read, it is that the consumer is looking for value and or experience if they are going to get in their car and drive somewhere. And they were not getting that at department stores. They weren't finding that, you know, the price to value that they were getting was worth going to these stores. And compared to, let's say, a TJ Maxx, which is a traditional open air tenant, you know, certainly of ours, but in many open air centers, where it's both value and experience, the experience of being able to go and look through new value items that you wouldn't be able to find at the kind of pricing in a department store has been a big trend change for consumers. And I think this isn't something I've read, but I think that the shopper has become, and actually I think I have read this, has become much more empowered through online, through their phones, to find value in all sorts of things that they're looking for, that's become part of our culture as consumers. We're not just going to the store and buying the thing that the store has. We can look online and find the best price, find the quickest delivery, find, you know, the thing that's going to be working the best for us, whether it's Amazon or other online vendors. And I think that's translated through the mall and open air experiences.
So, but wasn't TJ Maxx in traditional malls before they were in open air malls?
I have not seen TJ Maxx in malls. I've
Is
only
that right?
experienced them.
Okay,
in
so open air shopping.
And
these open air shopping centers, you're not calling them malls. You're saying open air shopping. Actually, what's the vernacular? What are you calling them? Open air what?
We call them shopping centers, but for listeners,
so the open air shopping centers, what are the component parts of the shopping center that are, besides the stores themselves, are there other components here that shoppers value, that people who the experience, that add to the experience?
Open air experience includes convenience and service functions like the nail salon, the hair salon, the cell phone, the place to grab a quick lunch. Those are big factors in why open-air centers have been a draw.
Why do you say the cell phone?
If you need, if a person needs to fix their phone.
You're saying a cell, an outlet, yes. Like it could have a Verizon store or
Correct.
An AT&T store. Okay.
Correct. Lunch hour quick things, go to the UPS store, that are not there in the malls, or even if they are, it's a much bigger ordeal.
Okay, so when you are open air shopping centers, I in my own head, I just was thinking in terms of what you were referring to are were more of a lifestyle mall, but an open air lifestyle mall. You're talking about, you know, these big shopping centers that really are a traditional component to the whole shopping experience. I mean, a lot of those were kind of knocked out by malls, it seems to me. That, I mean, I grew up in a town where there was an avenue called Washington Avenue that was the shopping center of the town, until a mall came along. And the mall decimated that street. Everybody went to the mall. And now things have kind of swung back the other way into this open air type of concept. Now, let me ask you about, I know that you have some thoughts on secondary and tertiary markets as well. What about secondary and tertiary markets in terms of retail real estate?
Sure. I just want to get back to your comment about your experience with shopping centers and the mall becoming the place. It was really the third issue, I think, that malls are having in the U.S. specifically, and that is that malls have not become the centers of the universe that they used to be, and that they are and have adapted to becoming in countries like China and Australia, where the mall has a much smaller component of retail and has many more community center types of aspects to it, like after-school programs or grocery store. They've maintained their strong presence as the place where communities come and congregate. And the U.S. has not, our malls have not done a great job with that, being led by failing department stores. So that was just the final piece I wanted to give on where I think there could have been more growth or more turnaround for malls. And maybe there still will if that can happen.
And gotcha.
I'll go to where secondary and tertiary markets have value is that often the retail in those markets has much less competition than a primary market, a metro market that has several trade areas close together, and one store of the same chain may be diluting the sales of another store. So the sort of the monopolistic position that some of these secondary and tertiary markets have for their center of retail make those retail assets perform very well. And then the secondary aspect is the real estate itself is cheaper. You know, the land is cheaper, the town is cheaper. So therefore, the rent is typically cheaper for these retailers. So their operating costs are going to be lower. Now that's that their net is offset by less population growth, less income growth in metro markets. But the combination of captive audience with lower operating costs is why we think that secondary and tertiary markets are doing well and continuing to do well for retailers and the landlords that rent to those retailers.
Okay, so there's opportunities there. And we have seen spillover from the big cities into secondary markets. I think that people realize there's an opportunity there. Maybe less so in retail, I don't know. But let me ask you about retail mix, because you were, and you alluded to this earlier, you were talking about some of the different vendors that would be in a successful shopping center. And I think there's always a temptation with the unsophisticated real estate investor to have a piece of property with several spaces to rent, to take money, sign a lease and take money from anybody who wants to occupy that space without thinking necessarily in terms of strategy, like what kind of mix is going to be necessary for one of these retailers to play off the other, to feed to the other. What about retail mix? What do you know about the retail mix and tenant relationships that make a shopping center successful?
Sure. I mean, that's a great question. There's a very strong amount of tension between making money through investment and providing the customer with an ideal experience through tenant mix. And one should lead to the other, but it doesn't always. And where we see that in the clearest way is many of the lifestyle centers that have been developed. And just to be clear about a lifestyle center, that's where they're have typically more high-end tenants with beautiful landscaping and common areas and fountains and really beautifully built out stores, and it's they curate really like a beautiful outdoor shopping center experience, but often to put that together, the capital involved makes it such that it's challenging to get a comparable yield on investment to a center that may not be quite as attractive, but still brings in a lot of customers for the specific stores that they have. So, you know, as an example, as when an investor is looking at deals, a seller of a shopping center, they're focused on cap rate, and that's an unlevered yield on the current income of the property. So if they have a vacancy, they're going to look to fill that vacancy with anybody paying rent, rather than maybe if there's a gym next door to the vacancy, finding that Lululemon or that juice bar that will ideally complement the gym. There, if there's a blood bank that is out there that wants that space and will pay a good rent, they're much more likely to put the blood bank in than wait, you know, what could be a year to put the ideal complementary tenant. So that tension exists all the time. And the more successful shopping centers that that you see in the market are taking into account both those things, practical retailers with practical common areas and practical aesthetics with a mix that is going to be enjoyable for the consumer.
What about just the uniqueness of the tenants? Because what I've seen with a lot of downtowns in American cities, smaller scale cities in particular, have woken up to this whole idea that, you know, having a Starbucks and an Applebee's does nothing to make us distinctive, because every town's got it. We become anywhere USA. But if we have a brew pub that's an independent that you don't find somewhere else, and it's got a good concept going, it's a lot of fun and it's got a good concept going, that's something that can actually draw somebody off the freeway and get them to come to our downtown. Whereas Applebee's and Starbucks, you know, just isn't going to do that. What about that in a shopping center environment? Is that also part of the calculus there?
It is another strong tension. It's such a great point you're making, because some of the strongest shopping centers we see in the United States have that local loyalty theme. You know, if you see a center in a given market where there's a sports team or a university that's very popular, and there are stores that are somehow related to that, they're selling things from the university or the sports team, or a restaurant, like you said, that has been in that town. Maybe they've been in the downtown and they've moved to the shopping center, but it's been generational that people in that town have known that restaurant, have loyalty to that. Those are some of the strongest retail assets that we see in the market. But the tension is that local tenants in general have typically much less strong financials than the Applebee's and the Starbucks, that even when business is down, their balance sheets and the leases that are signed can get you through rough periods. So from a financial aspect, and what's important about that, aside from just your general stability of the asset, is the typically these assets have loans on them, and the lender is going to be way more aggressive on loan terms and a better partner when they're seeing more of those national chains on the rent roll. So the center might do better with a lot of strong, loyal locals, because more people will come and therefore the sales volumes will be up. But having probably a nice mix of both is the ideal, so that the asset gets the right kinds of credit for financials of the tenants that are in the space, and therefore better loans, while having some local flavor to keep that loyal customer coming to the asset.
Yeah, let me ask you about one other aspect of what's going on in retailing right now, the omni-channel. the whole omni-channel of approach to retailing. I can tell you that recently I was in a different U.S. state. I'm walking through a mall, my phone dings, and it was a text message that knew I was in the mall, and it knew I was passing a particular shop because I had signed up. It was actually a Simon property, obviously a huge mall operator. And so it both tracked my whereabouts, but then we also have, and would alert me that, hey, there's buy this in the next 30 minutes and you get a 20% discount or what have you. But then there's also this whole, you know, order it online, pick it up in the store, or you can find it in the store and then order it online, however you want to play it. What about that?
Yeah, the former part of just the alerts when based on geography are still evolving, and there's all sorts of privacy issues and people's comforts with that. The latter about buy online, pickup in store has really been game changing for retail for bricks and mortar and certainly open air shopping centers. The research has shown that the strictly online purchase and returns is very, very costly and eats into a huge chunk of the profits for retailers. You may be aware Target has come out and said 90% of their online purchases are coming from stores, whether local stores are delivering to people, or even cheaper for the customer to go and pick up the merchandise from the local store. It's the integration of online and bricks and mortar that has really increased all of these strong retailers that have done that well, their sales through both. It's a high percentage of the returns that are made to bricks and mortar stores. The retailers have reported that people are then buying more than the thing that they were returned in the store when they go back to return. So that's been a big game changer. And along that those lines, the store itself has really become a new distribution hub for these retailers. So you may be reading Amazon and many retailers are trying to add to their real estate portfolios to add distribution centers around the country. It's going to be hard to find real estate that will work better and closer to population than many of these retail stores that can either ship from the store, or more ideally for the retailer, have the customer that bought that product online come and pick it up from the store. A great example of both experience and a great online integration is Ulta Cosmetics. Certainly Dick's Sporting Goods is another one where jumping a little bit to COVID, but COVID expedited, people were buying all sorts of sporting equipment and exercise equipment, and they made the ability to buy and pick it up from the store extremely seamless, which really helped their profitability during COVID.
Interesting. I also noticed that Amazon has a deal with Kohl's where if you want to return something, you just bring it in to Kohl's, and Kohl's will package it up for you and send it back. So they make it really easy, but they must be giving something to Kohl's in return for that. So I would imagine that's still eating into some of Amazon's profits because, Kohl's, do you know what the deal is there with Kohl's, or what are they getting in return?
I don't know what the deal is, but I think it's probably similar to what I said. Number one, the cost to return, especially for free, is so expensive that almost anything they need to spend will be cheaper than that. And then from Kohl's perspective, bringing that person into the store, even if they're just there to return the item, there's a high likelihood that they're going to buy something from Kohl's. So if I'm Kohl's, I don't need to even get paid for that. I just want you, Amazon customer, to come into my store because I know you're probably going to buy something.
Oh, I see. Yeah, interesting. At the point you were making earlier that, yeah, if you come in the store to pick it up, like I'm the retailer who you order from, you come in the store to pick it up, but hey, I get a chance to, my eyes are wandering all over and I get exactly a chance right to see some other things I'm going to buy. So it becomes a double or triple play. So the other thing is that Kohl's, at least the one I go to, when you go in, it's not up front. You have to walk through the store to get to where the pickups are or the returns. Well, or the pickups for that matter, right, which is a good strategic move because it absolutely forces me to wander along.
I mean, personally, I don't think I'd ever return something to a store without buying something else. Once I'm making that trip and spending that time getting to a store, I'm gonna meander a little bit.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, the other thing is I noticed that when you're expecting something to be delivered at your home, you can be a little bit antsy. At least I get, working from home right now, I get a little antsy about it showing up. I'm checking multiple times a day to see if something's out there. And whereas when they say, hey, it's been, your package is ready, it's at Kohl's or it's at Target or it's at Best Buy, it gives me a chance to get out of the house. It's a little drive there, get some fresh air and pick it up that way. It's also more protected. You don't have porch pirates
absolutely
coming to steal it.
That's
anyway,
right.
We're out of time. Our guest has been Yoel Meyerfeld. He's co-CEO of Chase Properties. They operate in several property types, including retail, of course, which is why Mr. Meyerfeld is so well informed about what's going on in the retail business these days. Yoel, thank you very much for taking the time. I appreciate the walkthrough. There's some interesting insights you've shared with us.
Sure. Thank you for having me. This was a great conversation, Mike. I appreciate it.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.